Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number 5, we have a UK bank shutting down RT's accounts in what many people are decrying as a direct form of pressure on alternative media. The National Westminster Bank abruptly and with no explanation all of a sudden declared that each and every one of RT's accounts was closed and that the decision is irreversible, which prompted Editor-in-Chief Margarita Simonyan to fume on Twitter and sarcastically remark, "Long live freedom of speech." The British government said that it had nothing to do with this decision and that a private bank can make whatever private choices it wants with its private clientele. But the Russian Foreign Ministry differs in this account and said in this statement that, quote, "This situation will entail insurmountable obstacles for the TV channel's work in the UK, as this can be seen as a move coordinated with British authorities and taken to get rid of a mass medium, which is unfavorable for UK officials but popular with the British audience." End quote. Russia has a great point too, because this account closure occurred during a low point in bilateral relations with the UK, particularly as it relates to Boris Johnson irresponsibly talking about downing Russian anti-terrorist jets in Syria, and the pre-existing speculation that the UK might try to outright ban RT from the country. We should also be realistic too and pull away from the UK's diplomatic statement of innocence and understand that governments do exercise a lot of pressure and influence on private companies, no matter how strongly this runs counter to their liberal democratic message of freedom. Look no further than the dozens of companies that voluntarily cooperated with the NSA over in the US, and how at the end of the day, it's the government who collects the taxes, audits them, and can make life for your company and family a living hell if you don't comply with their demands. That's most likely how the US government got all those tech companies to do its bidding, and is probably similar to the methods that the UK employed in getting National Westminster Bank to do theirs. At the end of the day, guys, this proves that there really is a war going on against free speech and alternative media. The next one up are the joint Russian-Egyptian war games and the speculative talk that Moscow could even open up a military facility in the strategic North African nation. Russian paratroopers are taking part in the Defenders of Friendship 2016 anti-terrorist drills with Egypt along the Mediterranean coast, which marked the first time that such an activity has been carried out by Russian troops in continental Africa. That by itself is reason enough for this to be big news, but just as importantly is the unconfirmed talk that surfaced in the Russian media right around this time, that Moscow might even return to its Soviet-era military facility in Sidi Barani near the Libyan border. It's not likely that this would happen overnight if ever a decision were even made in this regard, and it's much more probable that this information was leaked to the press to coincide with the joint war games and strengthen the impression that they'll have throughout the region. It's well known that Egypt used to be a close Soviet ally under President Nasser, but this changed after his death in 1970 when his successors disengaged from Moscow and rapidly pivoted towards Washington. That was a major game changer in this part of the world during the old Cold War, and it's remained a geopolitical constant up until current President Sisi's 2013 military coup against Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed Morsi. This strained ties with the US but brought Egypt under the heavy influence of Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Gulf Cooperation Council that it leads, which invested billions of dollars into the country since that time and have since become Cairo's closest allies. Egypt is still on civil terms with the US, don't get me wrong, but it's just that it decisively moved closer to Saudi Arabia after Washington shunned it after the coup. In the past couple of years, however, Egypt has made great strides in improving its relationship with Russia, and it seems as though President Sisi is trying to vaguely follow in the footsteps of Nasser by strengthening ties with Moscow. This is a wise move, since it helps to diversify Egypt's foreign policy dependency on the US and the Gulf, both of which represent the unipolar world, and it allows Cairo the possibility of exploring its role in the emerging multipolar world order. The world witnessed earlier this month how Egypt voted in support of a Russian UN resolution on Syria after having earlier hosted several rounds of talks with the opposition. Cracks are also emerging between Cairo and Riyadh due to a controversial island deal earlier this year, and the Saudis' recent halting of oil supplies to the North African nation. Overall, my forecast is that Egypt is moving closer to Russia in order to balance out the Saudis' influence, but that Riyadh might react in such a childish and possibly even hostile way to all of this that it accelerates Cairo's tilt towards Moscow. Third in our countdown is the tragic passing of King Bhumibol Adulyadej and the significance that this holds for Thailand. King Bhumibol ruled over Thailand since right after the end of World War II in 1946, up until just last week. So his reign was very symbolic as representing the entire continuum of Thailand's post-war history and all of the struggles and successes that it entailed. The country underwent 19 coup attempts since then, 12 of which were successful, with the last one occurring in 2014. And also saw such epics as the war in Vietnam and subsequent fallout up to the 1997 Asian financial crisis and the rise of ASEAN. Many Thais revered their king and looked up to him as a source of stability amidst the ever-changing conditions that their country found itself in. And just as importantly, every military leader that came to power in one way or another sought his blessing. That's the case with the current leader, Prayuth Chan-o-cha. And it's why the passing of King Bhumibol and the eventual accession of Crown Prince Maha Vajiralongkorn could lead to very real changes in Thai society. The former king was a traditionalist who supported the 2014 coup against Yingluck Shinawatra, the sister of deposed former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. Thaksin and his sister represent the rural interests of the northeastern region of Isan, and are known for their embrace of populism just as much as the pro-Americanism, which has historically been a mainstay of Thailand's geopolitics. They also back the so-called Red Shirts, which were responsible for street violence in the past and want to overthrow the present government in order to bring the Shinawatras back to power. Prayuth Chan-o-cha has decisively pivoted his country closer to China ever since he's been in office, and this is seen most powerfully by the plan to build what I've called the ASEAN Silk Road, which is a high-speed railway from the Yunnan capital of Kunming all the way down to Singapore, pivotally passing through the infrastructure crossroads of ASEAN that we all know as the Kingdom of Thailand. The U.S. has an interest in disrupting this project or establishing proxy control over it, but it can't do so with the patriotic Prayuth Chan-o-cha running the country, which is why it might try to coerce or influence the Crown Prince, rumored to be a Western-loving playboy, to eventually pull the crown support out from under the general's feet and lend important normative backing to a future red shirt color revolution against him. Our runner-up is the parliamentary election in Montenegro and how it disproves the ruling party's claims that most of the population want NATO membership. Incumbent Prime Minister Milo Djukanovic made it seem in the run-up to this election that it would be confirmation of the Montenegrin people's desire to join NATO, while the opposition steadfastly claimed that it would be an indirect referendum on membership in this military bloc. Well, the results are in. Djukanovic was debunked since his party only won 41% of the vote and gained 35 seats in parliament, six shy of the absolute majority needed to rubber stamp admission to NATO. The two main opposition parties, the Democratic Front and Key, won 20% and 11% each, bringing them to 33%. On the surface, yes, it's true. Djukanovic's Democratic Party of Socialists did win the largest plurality in the country, but is still short of both the numerical and parliamentary majority needed to give undeniable normative support to Montenegro's move towards NATO. We also need to remember that if he didn't steal any of these votes, which is a legitimate question to ask given his 25-year history in power and the numerous electoral accusations leveled against him during the past quarter century, then he definitely gained some from his anti-Russian and anti-Serbian fear-mongering, which went as far as accusing Moscow of funding the opposition and carrying out a dramatic stunt of arresting 20 Serbs on election day on the trumped-up charges that they are planning to commit terrorist attacks against the government. Because neither of these strategies worked in handing him the majority that he so desperately coveted, he's forced to enter into a coalition government in order to try and make this happen. And it was just announced that he wants to partner with a small party that represents the rights of the Albanian, Croatian, and Slavic Muslim or Bosniak minorities in the country. This is very ironic, since Montenegro is under threat by Albanian nationalists in occupied Kosovo, which claim that Podgorica is stealing land from their self-proclaimed state. One hardcore nationalist, Tahir Veliu, even visited the country this summer to promote his book about the revival of fascist-era Greater Albania, which he and his supporters say must include Montenegro. It's very ironic, then, that Djukanovic would team up with an opposition party which supports the interests of the Albanian minority in Montenegro, which is just a euphemism for advocating this militant vision of Greater Albania, which has already brought so much pain and suffering to Serbia. The reason that a national leader would sell himself out like this is because he doesn't see himself as the leader of Montenegro, but as the don of a nationwide criminal enterprise, one which he's accused of heading and which is suspected of engaging in the illegal cigarette trade and shady real estate deals, among many, many others. Djukanovic doesn't care about NATO per se. What he wants is protection from prosecution in the event that he's ever unseated from power. And he knows that by selling his country to the bloc, even if this means vulnerably exposing it to the dangers of fascist-era Greater Albania, then so be it, as long as he can live the rest of his life as a free man and not have to worry about the scales of justice tipping against him. At our top spot, we've got the outcome of the BRICS summit in Goa, which was a godsend for Russian-Indian relations, but comparatively disappointing when it came to new opportunities for multilateral cooperation. To start off, I want to tell everybody how genuinely happy I am to see that Russian-Indian relations were reinvigorated, since this is something which I've actively encouraged for months now as the only thing which could hold New Delhi back from a full-on pro-American pivot. I wrote at length about the moves that both sides should do in my Katihan think tank articles about the meaning of multipolarity, managing the contested countries, and how Russia's diplomatic balancing act in Asia is to the benefit of its Chinese ally. And I am overjoyed to see that Russia and India both had in mind the intention to strengthen their ties and reaffirm their friendship during this historic event. We saw proof of this happening by the raft of deals that were signed between the two sides, including the Russian provisioning of S-400 missiles to India by 2020, a joint venture to produce military helicopters, nuclear energy deals, and a $500 million joint investment fund. All these are welcome and prove that Russia is intent on saving India from itself, so to speak, in the sense of fighting to forestall or potentially even mildly reverse the country's recent pro-American reorientation. If last weekend's events were just a bilateral Russian-Indian summit, then I'd celebrate them as one of the most productive meetings between the two in perhaps a generation. But since they formally took place during the multilateral BRICS summit, we need to look at them in context and compare them to everything else that transpired, which, sadly, wasn't much. Sure, all sides agreed to continue working on the new development bank and currency reserve fund that were announced during last year's summit in Ufa, and they all signed the Goa Declaration of generic but positive statements about their support of multipolarity and opposition to regime change. But all in all, it was a lot of glitz, glamour, and photographs, but hardly any substance. Everyone's talking about Russia and India, and with good reason. But nobody's talking about BRICS per se. Or if they are, they can't name one tangible collective accomplishment reached during this year's meeting that separates it from the rest of the ones that have taken place over the years. And that, guys, is a problem. And it confirms what sober-minded critics have alleged about the American fostered disunity in BRICS having undermined the global governance framework that many of the partners and their international supporters assumed that the organization had. BRICS is a useful multilateral platform for progressively reforming part of the international economic and financial architecture, as well as bringing together each country's experts. But it does not have any solid geopolitical basis so long as one of the three main Eurasian members is in a military strategic partnership with the same overseas country that's actively undermining its two continental peers. Okay, guys, and there you have it. That's the end of this week's episode of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank you guys for tuning into my show. And I hope you guys will share it on social media. Thanks, have a nice weekend, and hopefully you'll tune in again next week. Bye.